Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I'm in rainy Boston today, broadcasting from WGBH, Boston Public Radio. And this is a day of mourning and remembrance as people across the city pause to think about the horrific bombings that took place a year ago. Today, the vice president visited Boston, which is just one way this day is different from a year ago, when there were no dignitaries, no rain either, just people out on a spring Patriots Day to run and celebrate before things changed forever. And this hour, we'll talk about the continuing unrest in Ukraine, as well as the interim prime minister announces an anti-terror operation is underway in the country's eastern region, an operation that Russia is calling a crackdown on dissent from a repressive government in Kiev. And setting the table for the Passover Seder, our guest wants kosher sangria on the table, and some lawmakers in Louisiana are setting the table for a big political fight over making the state book the King James Bible to join Louisiana's state bird, I guess, the brown pelican. But first, when Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick stopped by the studios of WGBH yesterday, he shared with me the challenge of coming up with something to say a year after the tragedy of the Marathon bombings. "I have no idea what to say," he told me with that broad smile and those energetic eyes before he sat down. "I just don't know what to add. I'll think of something," he told me. And he found something appropriate to say at the ceremonies today, but yesterday he was still mulling it over. He told me the story of how the bombings taught him what a small world it is, discovering while visiting one of the severely wounded in the hospital that she had served him and his family at a restaurant. He remembered, and it reminded him that we're all neighbors. "Tell that story," I said. "Maybe I will," he said. And he thought out loud with me yesterday about all those emotions from a year ago.
For me, the takeaway was how we pulled together, how the medical teams came together to care for and comfort the people who were hurt, how law enforcement came together to solve the crime, and how regular citizens came together to show what a community looks like.
We had an argument this morning. You know, some people were saying, wow, wasn't it amazing that lockdown was ordered and everybody did it? And other people were saying, no, it was never ordered. People
right.
were just invited to participate. Settle it. Which was it?
Well, I asked.
Asked nicely.
I did. I asked out of concern for safety and because we had an awful lot of things happening without knowing the scope or scale of what we were dealing with. It was very, very helpful. And on the whole, people did respect it.
Now, I don't expect you to, claim there was some sort of magic in your particular approach that caused people to comply. It was certainly a function of the events themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But it raised your leadership profile nationally, wouldn't you say?
I don't know. I wasn't thinking about that then. I haven't thought about it very much since. I was thinking about what we needed to do to make sure we were all focused, all of us, not just those in official capacity or with an official role, but the whole community was focused on getting to the bottom of this as quickly as possible and staying safe.
President Obama suggested that your style would be great at the federal level. Is he doing you any favors by saying something like that,
Probably.
Or is he complicating your life?
He's mostly complicating my life, John. I haven't been at this job for so long that it doesn't blow my mind when the president of the United States calls you by name and says nice things publicly, and I appreciate that. But I think that the compliment belongs to the team that acted like a team, and to the citizenry who were just marvelous in their consistent and repeated demonstrations of kindness and grace.
Is a tragedy like the bombing, in some sense, an easier event to deal with in terms to form a team than, say, something like the policy implications of the launch of Obamacare in the state of Massachusetts, which was a different kind of challenge and maybe didn't go so well from a team perspective?
Well, two things I'd say. First of all, you'd rather not test that thesis because you need a tragedy in order to do so. I will say that When you think about what we've been able to accomplish in the Commonwealth in the last 8 years in education, in healthcare coverage, where even with the implementation of Obamacare, we have added more than 200,000 to what was already the highest level of healthcare coverage in the country. What we've been able to do in veteran services, in infrastructure investment, we are where we lead the nation. We have shown that that we can work together as a team. I will say that this notion of common destiny as a motivator for common cause is something I feel very strongly about, and how I have tried to govern. And I think that everybody got a glimpse of that and understood that in the midst of that tragedy in a, I think, a particularly acute and important way.
Thinking back to the bombing now, there was a foreign policy dimension to that story as well as a domestic policy dimension. What do you think of the second-guessing of Russian information sharing and federal, state, local information sharing? And how do you, as a governor, think about homegrown radicalization, which was part of what happened independent of Russia here?
That's right. Well, first of all, on the second-guessing, I think it's inevitable. I knew a year ago of the about the fact that Russian intelligence had not responded to inquiries from the FBI for, I think, more than a year before the event. And, of course, that's worrisome. But most of what we know today does not necessarily suggest that this that it was knowledge that could have prevented what happened, which really comes to the second point you you raised, and that is about the radicalization of people in our own midst. And obviously that is something to be concerned about, but also to be careful about. And the care I mean here is both in terms of how we are alerted to specific acts and specific behaviors, without turning that into categorical condemnation or frankly suspicion about whole groups of people.
Law enforcement might say, or maybe the strident voices in the media might say, that the only preventable approach would be to act on every tip that the FBI has and maybe round people up and bring them in as a preventive matter for an event like this. But ruling that out, because it's not practical, what is the preventable approach to radicalization?
I do think that it will continue to be a matter of judgment, and we need to make sure that our law enforcement teams have both the resources and the training to exercise that judgment wisely. I am not prepared to trade off the liberties that distinguish us as a country, you know, for an absolute permanent lockdown, to use the term that you used earlier, and I don't think most Americans are.
Finally, you alluded to just how complicated the question of are you running for higher office makes your life as governor here in the Commonwealth. But with that issue aside, and please feel free to comment on it if you like.
You can put that issue aside.
Yeah. What do you make of the campaign finance issues in politics for anyone who might be considering running for a federal office? What do you see?
I'm worried about the democracy. And I was worried about our democracy even before the Supreme Court decisions, but they complicate the picture, I think, even further. We have an electorate, certainly here in Massachusetts, and I think it's not unlike much of the rest of the country, where an awful lot of people don't participate because they don't think it matters. They don't think they can get the attention of their elected leaders unless they're able to write a check. I don't think that's what the founders had in mind. I don't think that's what most Americans have in mind in terms of a healthy democracy. I don't like the decisions of the Supreme Court, but I respect the authority of the Supreme Court to make those decisions. And I think the only way they're going to be changed is by constitutional amendment, and we ought to be thinking about that. But beyond that, we need folks who are going to get into public life and run for public office who have in mind the voice and the interests of the people who cannot write that check. And because that's the only way I think we're going to get a better government, and we deserve better government.
People like Deval Patrick?
Well, I hope I've – you know, I wasn't trying to call attention to myself, but I certainly hope that is the kind of leadership that we've provided in this time to steward the government of Massachusetts, and certainly the kind of civic engagement we've invited people to see.
Well, I saw the back door, so I decided to knock. But Governor Patrick, thank you so much.
Thank you.
One more thought now from the streets of Boston. You know, it is said of runners, and I'm in a very small way in a position to confirm this, having run a couple of marathons a long time ago, that runners are a superstitious lot. On the morning before a race, that first breath of outside air, the first light, the first moment you open your eyes, you can feel it. Something momentous is about to happen. And exactly a year ago, that was the feeling for the 26,839 people who were choosing their breakfast, facing a day that would put them at the starting line of the Boston Marathon. Momentous, that starting line. The physical and mental tests of 26.2 miles. That finish line. Will I finish? Will I beat my old time? For the very, very few, will I set a world record? For even fewer than that, for two young men, exactly a year ago, they also felt that something momentous would happen as they faced the first light of the day. They knew they would make it to the finish line with their explosives, that they knew. Their own finish line would come many days later. A lockdown, a curfew, people in their homes, a city of checkpoints, death, injuries, all of the bodies that heroically greeted the day to be tested by a race, limbs insulted by shrapnel and fire, hearts tested by a terrible tragedy. I recall all of that from being here then. But a year ago, no one knew any of that. Just that something momentous would happen. For each runner, they knew it would be a momentous day. It was a momentous day for the whole city of Boston, the nation, and the world, of course. And last night, as the year anniversary of the Boston bombings approached, I could feel my runner's superstitions as I observed that eclipse of the moon out my window. A blood moon, they call it. Did you see it? The earth blocks the sun, and the moon dims to a dull red in overcast Boston. It all happened behind the clouds. But I could feel this year, since the bombing, coming to an end, just like an eclipse, with relentless astronomical precision covering the past. This is the last moment we'll be able to look back and say, a year ago it was a beautiful morning. It's raining today in Boston. None of that had happened yet a year ago. Last April 15th, we weren't thinking about any bombings. Last birthday, she wasn't injured. Last year, he was still alive. Last year at this time, it was just midterms and taxes and springtime. It's the last time we'll be able to say that. Like an eclipse, an anniversary comes and goes, leaving its mark on the observers, on all of us. But in the sky, the air, the motions of the planets, it's all as it was. We humans must carry the details of our lives into the future. Time simply moves forward. A year has passed. It's a lot. It's momentous, this anniversary. But it's small, too. Like an eye blink or an eclipse. And there will be many more.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The escalating tensions in eastern Ukraine are being called Russian incitement by the West and a crackdown on free speech by the Russians. Here's U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki speaking after a conversation between President Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin yesterday, where there was apparently no progress reported on easing the tensions.
We're very concerned about evidence of Russian support for a concerted, orchestrated campaign of incitement and sabotage to undermine and destabilize the Ukrainian state.
But can anyone stop this unrest? And can it be said that Ukraine is already essentially lost? Joining me now is Ian Bremmer, president and founder of Eurasia Group, a global political research and consulting firm. Ian, welcome back.
Delighted to be with you.
Is there any way to stop Russia here, or stop what looks like a green light from Russia or from pro-Russian insurgents to confront the Ukrainian government?
I think it's more a question of how they're going to do it than whether. You know, if the Ukrainian government actually follows through on militarily trying to roust these occupiers in southeast Ukraine, they're probably going to lose a big part of their country. If they don't, they're probably going to lose a big part of their country. It's gotten to the point that they don't really have any good options.
And Putin has called the Ukrainians bluff, and the Ukrainians are basically waving the flag. Can anyone help us here?
Yeah, and the point is that the United States is very clear that there's no military assistance coming to the Ukrainians. They're more than willing to continue to talk about sanctions. President Obama just yesterday had his sixth direct phone call with Putin. It's the same conversation. It's you got to leave Crimea. It's don't go any farther. There are going to be consequences. Those consequences will be tougher sanctions. Look, the Russians have paid something like $100 to $200 billion in subsidies for Ukraine over the last 20 years. The country's a basket case. This is not about economics for the Russians. And the United States can certainly hurt Russia over the long term, but none of that is going to help the Ukrainians over the course of the coming weeks. The question for the Americans right now is how much do we want to continue to support Kiev as they lose eastern Ukraine, as they lose it? Do we want to try to ensure that there is something that remains of Ukrainian government that tilts to the west? And if there is, then, you know, the Americans, the Europeans need to focus all of their efforts on that. Because right now, it's going to be tough not just to keep east Ukraine, which is falling by the moment, but also to maintain anything that looks like the existing Ukrainian government in Kiev.
From your perspective as a research and a political consultant, is there a partition option here, an eastern Ukraine versus western Ukraine with Kiev as the capital?
We're moving in that direction. The problem is that east Ukraine does not want to be partitioned into Russia. If you were to have a vote on the ground right now, you'd probably get about 20-25% of the population supporting a movement, an annexation by Russia, very different than what you have on the ground in Crimea. So if this breaks into violence, it's likely to escalate very quickly, and it's hard to imagine the Russians just stopping with interference in East Ukraine at that point, which means that the level of support the U.S. provides for the Ukrainians would and the Europeans would have to grow very significantly to keep that government intact. Right now, just don't see that happening. The U.S. pretty slow moving on this, sticking to the we're going to punish the Russians, we're going to put sanctions, we're going to give direct economic aid to the Ukrainians. This situation has spiraled out of control very much beyond that.
Finally, why would Vladimir Putin, thinking back, you know, to the Cold War now once again, why would Vladimir Putin want to set up a Brandenburg Gate kind of tense border between western Ukraine and Poland? What does that get him? And isn't he just looking for a buffer state, a kind of peaceful Ukraine as a buffer to NATO?
I think that the Russians right now are under an enormous amount of pressure. You have to understand, long term, everything that Putin has done here is a loser for him and his country. They've been in decline economically, politically, diplomatically, and demographically for 20 years now. They can take Ukraine, and if they really want, they can get rid of this Ukrainian government. They can have a buffer state. They're going to have to spend a lot more that they can't really afford on their own defense and national security. They're going to be stuck trading with countries like China that are going to drive an incredibly hard deal in price to work with them because they won't have any options. Long term, this is a disaster for Russia. But in the near term, if they want to bring the Ukrainians down with them, they certainly can. And unfortunately, that is the scenario that's now playing out.
Any chance that you're wrong? Lots of people have been saying this is a loser. He's running out of options. This is a lose-lose-lose situation. But to the world, it looks like Putin is winning, winning, winning.
Yeah, but domestically is the issue. In Russia right now, Putin's approval rates are over 80%. They were at 60% at the beginning of this Ukraine crisis. It's from the Russian perspective, this is an aggrieved nation that the West has tried to take advantage of at every step over the past 20 years, from NATO enlargement to pipeline diversification to the Libya removal of Gaddafi, and now to the abrogation of an agreed deal between the Ukrainian president and the opposition, leading to an illegitimate Ukrainian government. That is being rectified by their leader, President Putin. The Russian narrative is so radically different from what we've heard in the United States in the media. And unfortunately, much as we all agree with the American narrative, it's the Russians that are causing us the trouble right now, and they see the world very differently.
Ian Bremmer is president and founder of Eurasia Group, a global political research and consulting firm. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Later this hour, states have slogans and birds and state mottos, and who pays any attention to that? Should a state have an official book? Can you guess where this is going?
Hi, this is Deborah from Beverly, Massachusetts, just across the harbor from Salem. I think that Arthur Miller's The Crucible would be a good choice to represent Massachusetts because of the sad history of the witch trials. And I was surprised to see when I moved up here to Massachusetts that Halloween is celebrated across the state almost as much as Christmas.
My name is Andrew Pagliara, and I'm calling from New York City, New York. And the book for my town would probably be The Great Gatsby, just because of the overconsumption that New York City encapsulates.
Well, coming up, a discussion of how some Louisiana lawmakers want to make, you guessed it, the Bible the official state book, the King James Version. Join the conversation at 8778-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. More at 1-800-REPUTATION or at Reputation.com.
A couple of conversations now straight from the big book, the Bible. The first lighthearted and from the Old Testament, the second a bit heavier and involving the New Testament. It is the second day of Passover, the Jewish holiday commemorating the escape from Egypt and the biblical miracles that accompanied the flight of the Jews. The traditional Seder meal signifies deprivation, what the Jews didn't have on their way through the desert, for instance, no leavened bread. But what they had, apparently in abundance, was wine. During Passover, Jews are supposed to consume 4 glasses of wine, as they recall the plight of their ancestors, while eating the traditional dried fruits and bitter roots. Which to Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful Food podcast, spiritual foodie and opportunist, this can only mean one thing. Passover sangria.
Passover is a drinking holiday. In a Seder, Jews are supposed to consume 4 glasses of wine over the course of the Seder. Seder means order, so there's a very proscribed order for these things. But, you know, it dawned on me one year, I'm looking at the Seder plate, I'm looking at the food there, and I'm thinking, okay, we have this Manischewitz wine, which is sweetened red wine. It's like, sickeningly sweet. We have charoset, which is typically chopped apples and nuts meant to symbolize the mortar that the Jews used to build the pyramids. And then I see there's these other fruits and things on the table, and I'm thinking, we're like 2/3 of the way to sangria here. Let's just fill in the gaps. And what's a great thing to turn it into sangria is brandy, which is one of the few liquors that's pretty easy to find in a kosher for Passover form. And so I have come up with a recipe for Passover sangria.
All right. So what are the ingredients for Passover sangria, and how do you do it and maintain kosher and end up with something that's actually pretty festive?
Well, you start with the Manischewitz wine, which is sweetened red wine, as we said. Then you add in, I actually would call for Calvados, which is an apple brandy. It's going to be tough to find kosher for Passover Calvados if you want that kosher seal, if you're that observant, in which case you could substitute a plum brandy, let's say, like a Slivovitz. They make kosher Slivovitz. If you're in the middle of that range of spectrum of observance, any fruit brandy should be okay. And then you're going to want to add in that charoset, the chopped apples and nuts. Then you're going to add in some citrus juice, maybe a pinch of salt. And then here's where I'm going to throw you the curveball, John.
Do it.
Another part of the Passover observance is maror, bitter herbs, meant to symbolize the Jews, the bitter experience of slavery in Egypt. Most commonly, that means horseradish. So if this is your style, you could slice up some fresh horseradish and also put that into the sangria to add some real kick, sort of, you know, akin to a Bloody Mary experience.
Have you done this?
I have done it. I have done it, and it is – I like it with a little horseradish. It can be overdone, and you will lose a couple guests with it. But if you like that burn, a little bit of it, I think it's a very different drinking experience. And then just a lot of chopped fruit.
It sounds a little bit like, you know, wasabi-flavored grappa or something like that.
Yeah. Do they make that? That sounds exciting.
I don't think so. I do not think so. But we're in a very adventurous zone. But if you're going to get that genuine American, per se, Passover experience, you got to go with the Manischewitz.
I think that's right. Although even in my in-laws' household, and like I said, they keep kosher, they go with the Manischewitz for the sort of official part of the Seder. But then when it's time to just have some wine with dinner, they will open up other kosher wines that are closer to, quote-unquote, regular wine than Manischewitz.
And the kosher hangover cure for the next morning, you got one of those?
You know, that's a tough one because all the sugar in the Manischewitz will do a number on you. I usually already start getting a headache by the time the meal's over, before I've even gone to bed. I mean, the cure for a hangover, that is universal. Ideally, you want some bread, but that's obviously not going to work. But you really want grease, just like in college, greasy food and water before you go to bed, and you should be in good shape.
And maybe save a little horseradish for the next morning.
Yeah, that will clear out the cobwebs for sure.
Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful podcast. Thanks so much and happy Passover.
You too. Thanks, John.
Lots more of Dan Pashman at Sporkful.com. Being a state lawmaker means fixing deficits and adjusting taxes. You can choose license plate colors, declare sangria to be the state beverage. That might be controversial. How about a state book? There's a weighty issue for Louisiana lawmakers who got the idea from citizen Randy Dill. He's even picked the book he wants.
The Bible was their main inspiration, along with our forefathers, Washington and all of them. They looked to it for their inspiration for our country, to call upon God to help us. And God's intervened in our nation so many times.
It's Louisiana citizen Randy Dill speaking to KTBS in Shreveport this year. Lawmakers have forced a state house vote on making the King James Bible the state book of Louisiana, which has alarmed Zach Coplin, our next guest and a student at Rice University in neighboring Texas, who's already been advocating for more than a year to overturn Louisiana's Science Education Act, which allows religion-based creationism to be taught in public schools. Zach Coplin, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me on again.
So what is wrong with Louisiana wanting to have a state book and it happens to be the King James Bible?
The problem is the King James Bible doesn't actually represent the beliefs of the majority of Louisiana, whether it be Catholic or Hindu or Muslim or non-religious. There's a wide diversity of beliefs in the state, which is why we have an established separation of church and state.
Except for the state bird, it's not like anybody polled the citizens of the state and figured out if everybody loves cardinals and that becomes the state bird. I mean, I don't feel constrained to love a bird that's not my state bird in the state of New York.
Yeah, but the whole point is that there is a solid wall of separation. There's no requirement for everyone to read it if it's a state book, but it's an official endorsement of religion to make the King James Bible the state book.
What can you do about this?
People from all over the country can actually call in and tell the Louisiana legislature, the House and the Senate, to vote down this bill because it's unconstitutional and will end up with a court case that'll cost money. Now, if you're in Louisiana, you can actually show up and testify in opposition to this bill.
Now, they may be just doing this for political grandstanding. I mean, they know it's unconstitutional, that it'll get struck down, and they're just doing it to make their own point.
I mean, there are a lot of laws that I would regard as unconstitutional that exist in Louisiana, from an old 1981 law called the Balanced Treatment for Creation Science Act, which it was struck down by the Supreme Court, one of the most important rulings on creationism that's ever happened, but the state legislature refused to take it off the books. And one of the legislators who also sponsored the follow-up creationism law we have today in Louisiana said they wanted to keep it just in case the court ever reversed its decision.
Most people don't know the state bird of their state, the state song of their state, the, you know, state, you know, dish of their state. And I suspect that most people in Louisiana won't know the state book if this gets passed once the headlines are done. What do you think Louisiana is doing here? Just expressing a kind of free speech, thumbing your nose at the rest of the country? Or is it more like Eastern Ukraine? They're trying to break away.
I wouldn't really put it either way. I would say this is more an action of a couple lawmakers, and now that it's been introduced, there may be a lot of pressure from outside religious groups to make sure this passes. But I think this is from certain lawmakers who aren't thinking fully about the diversity of views in their own state. The King James Bible is not a Catholic book. The Catholic Church uses a different Bible, but the state itself is very Catholic. Even if we're going to, say, cut out everyone who's not Christian, this doesn't even reflect the views of many, many Christians in the state, Catholics and then Protestants who don't want to violate the separation of church and state. So this, I just don't think this is an accurate representation of the views of the people of Louisiana.
Zach Copland, a student at Rice University, created and leads the Repeal Creationism campaign to overturn Louisiana's Science Education Act. He also opposes the proposed state book, being the King James Bible in the state of Louisiana. Zach Copland, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
Imagine now back a year ago to the Boston Marathon bombing once again. And if you had been one of the injured and could still move, you and hundreds of others might have made your way to the Marathon medical tent to be treated and evaluated as to whether you needed to go to the hospital. In that tent or in the triage area right outside the tent, you would have seen the faces of many volunteers and heard the voice of one volunteer trying to manage the fear. Nurse Leslie Adams remembers.
The announcer had a very calm, quiet voice. There was no sense of panic in his voice, and he was able to relay information continuously. He was giving us direction every step of the way. I felt like there was never a moment of silence from him, and that really guided me in what I was doing.
That's Leslie Adams remembering the voice of John Anderson, who was directing the medical tent a year ago. His wife, Lori, a volunteer nurse, was working nearby. Their faces of calm, strength, humility, and caring also carry the emotions they felt, treating hundreds of wounded a year ago.
When the event, the first bomb went off, the tent itself kind of was like, what happened? You know, what was that? And as information and patients started to come in from the street, we were forced, unfortunately, to turn from a first aid tent into a trauma center.
What were your thoughts? Did you make eye contact across the crowds in those first hours?
So I work outside the tent, so I was probably 150 yards from where the bomb went off. So initially, what I saw first was people started running toward me, like a mass of people, and some of them had blood running down their faces or their body parts from shrapnel hits that were still running, those people. And the people that were bleeding, I directed into the tent. It was probably 15 or 20 minutes of getting the majority of the major wounded people in through the tent before I stepped into the tent. My husband stands in the middle of the tent, and he had been asking people if they'd seen me because I was out in the street and he was concerned. But I stepped in and I waved to him probably 50 feet away and just let him know I was okay then.
In a normal marathon, you can probably always help anybody, no matter what their complaint or concern is. In this case, were you able to help people?
People helped to whatever ability they could help, you know, whether it was putting a hand on someone's shoulder or it was actually holding gauze over a wound. People rose up. That's the biggest thing that I can say about the whole event, is to watch the medical personnel that were involved, whether it's the EMS, the doctors, the nurses, the athletic trainers, the podiatrists, whoever you want to take, they rose up. And that's the reason why everyone that came into that tent alive left that tent alive. And you can't have one person say, oh, it was because of this person or it was because of that person. It was because everybody stepped up. And because everybody stepped up, we can feel proud that we were able to help all of those people. The hundreds of people that were injured survive today and be moving forward.
I think it's a miracle. I think everybody in that tent saved everybody's life.
I know you're both very humble and you don't want to call attention to yourself, but was there a moment when you really felt like you had a responsibility, you were in control, and people needed to see that you had this tent under control or this place under control, this station under control, even if you knew you were a little bit over your head?
So for me, I'm the charge nurse in an ER, and I sort of take that role of, you know, lead when I need to. My lead role there was just to make sure that the tent doorway was clear and that the medics and the people running with the severely wounded could get access to the tent. I think that a lot of people have found John's role in the tent to be having a big impact, and he doesn't realize how much of an impact he had on the people in the tent. But I have heard it from every medical person I've dealt with since this bombing has told me that John made a difference for them.
What are your thoughts about that? You made a difference. You stepped up. You, suddenly there were some general stars on your helmet that you weren't wearing.
Well, as a teacher, I've been a teacher for over 25 years in a middle school classroom. Having that responsibility and having to have dealt with the training for a number of situations that I've never been involved in that had to do with school situations, I tried to do my best to disseminate information, to guide and direct the people inside of the tent. I never thought about it. It never entered my mind, oh my God, this is, you know, I've got to do this. It was, this is what needs to be done. I am here. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. But it appears from the people that my wife has talked to or other people have talked to me that I was able to maintain that calm environment in a less than calm situation. It still chokes me up. I still think about it.
It's pretty raw right now.
It is raw. There's no question about it. I was in a position to see things that most people don't ever see, whether they're an EMS person in the city or they're, you know, on the military battlefield. There are things that we're not supposed to witness. We didn't sign up for those things. There's a time and a place, and if you're in that place, you do what you can do. And that's what the people in Boston did that day, is they stepped up. I just want all of those people to understand that I'm here today speaking on behalf of all of them. I may be the voice that was inside of the tent that helped all of them, but all I did was direct them, and they did, you know, the real nitty-gritty work. As I've said a number of times, if I ever get hurt, thank God I live in the city of Boston.
And you're going to do it again this year?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Didn't have to think about that?
Not even a hesitation in my mind.
No, mine either. I think it's important to go back. We've been doing it for a really long time anyway, and I think that it's important for us to be there. I think there'll be a lot of emotion. There certainly is a lot of focus on the safety issues, and I think there'll be a lot of intensity in the morning for what's going to happen through the day. I actually look forward to the first runner coming so we can get to work and stop talking about it, because I think there'll be a lot of talk, and I think that is important but old too.
Well, here's a prayer for a lot of blisters and muscle aches and maybe some sunburn.
Yeah, that would not be a bad thing to have.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
John Anderson, Boston Marathon Medical Tent Coordinator, and his wife Lori Anderson, a charge nurse and volunteer at the Boston Marathon Medical Tent. From that medical tent out on the race course in Boston, the severely injured a year ago made their way to the world-class medical facilities in the city, where the life or death outcomes were the result of real expertise, more than just being strong and stepping up. As important as all that is, medical experience and know-how would be needed to keep the people with so many severe injuries from dying. And last year, Dr. Perrin Cobb, director of the Mass General Critical Care Center, knew his role exactly when he attended to six of the bombing victims. And Joanne Pomodoro, clinical social worker at MGH Back Bay, was ready to provide trauma counseling for an event that had no precedent. As this year comes to a close, Cobb and Pomodoro can think back with sadness about what they saw and look forward with some fear and excitement to next week. They are running the Boston Marathon for the very first time themselves in solidarity, they say, with the people they helped and saved.
Yeah, it was a terrific day. Obviously, it was beautiful. And I got an email from a colleague who indicated that there had been an explosion and that there was some need in the emergency department. So I immediately went down and saw this first wave of victims. Right then and there, you knew that a beautiful Patriots Day in the city of Boston was going to be very, very different. We had no idea at the time how different it was going to be, but that played out very rapidly.
Yes. I actually was getting ready to go play racquetball, and my cousin had called and said, there's an explosion at the marathon. My brothers are both first responders. So I was wondering where they were. I had no idea what was going on. I was in shock, just like everybody else. But then as the story progressed, you started to see a catastrophe, a traumatic event that I don't think any of us expected at that time. What I've noticed with the people I work with, it seems to be that everyone's working to have, I call it triumph over trauma. And it's amazing what I've seen and the resilience and the just the energy of everyone working together to support each other.
Is it possible to triumph over trauma, or do you absorb it in some way and move on?
I think there's the, you know, there are a couple senses of the reality, if you will. One of the terms that we've used, and I've talked to Joanne about this, is the surreal sense of the day. There's the activities. We're all prepared for emergency care, critical care, intensive care. And certainly as you see victims coming in, we jump to action. And that's what all the drills and the practice are about. But there's another level of reality, if you will, the surreal aspect, where you sort of get the sense we're in the middle of something really big. And you're trying to focus on the activity at hand, which is taking care of our amazing patients and their families. But you also had this sense that, am I safe? Are my colleagues safe? A number of us knew runners in the race, and there was sort of a sense that, is the next wave coming in going to include somebody I know? There were reports early on that there had been other explosions in other parts of the city, that the suspects were still out and about. So there were a number of really, really powerful emotions.
Joanne, contrast the trauma of the bombing with the continued trauma of the manhunt, of the level of stress that people were under for days and days and days. And of course, as you, a doctor, were under keeping those patients at Mass General alive. Mm-hmm. Joanne, you first.
You know, at Mass General, they saw all the physical, the medical trauma. And what I was dealing with was the psychological trauma. At that time, it was still shock. I think people just could not understand. And I think the word surreal is what we would use at that moment.
And you know what, John? It's you can use the analogy like a wound, right? I mean, you have the initial trauma that creates the physical wound, if you will. And that heals over time with scarring. And I think all of us had wounds, if you will, psychological wounds, and those are in the process of healing. We know that deep injuries can take months to years to heal, and I think that that's where we are, not only as individuals, but as a city and a region as well.
From the outside, most people would probably say, and there are probably only a couple more places in the world that they would say this about, if you're going to get seriously injured, boy, do it in Boston with the medical infrastructure that's there, the level of medical expertise. What were you most proud of what happened a year ago, and what surprised you, maybe even scared you a little bit about what this medical infrastructure can do or can't do?
I think that a silver lining coming out, if you will, of the response is an appreciation about the need for better prostheses. If there is going to be immediate injury and the inability to save limbs because of the destructive power of the bombs that were detonated, that we redouble our efforts for prostheses, artificial limbs. And I think we've seen a lot of progress in that domain as well. The thing that I think surprised us the most is how automatically people went into response mode. One of the most brilliant things that happened was the emergency medical system and the way that 260 patients were distributed equally across five trauma centers. You mentioned Boston being one of the places to respond. We have tremendous expertise with regard to trauma and critical care across the five centers. So that changed a mass casualty event, 260 victims, into a multiple casualty event for each hospital. You can imagine it would have been quite different, for example, if those 260 patients had gone to one hospital. So I think that worked incredibly well.
How many patients did you deal with personally?
We admitted 39 patients to Mass General that first day, and we took care of 6 patients in the surgical intensive care units at Mass General.
And you can see their faces now?
I can. And we talked about the scars earlier on. The motions are still quite real. To some degree, the scabs or the eschars get ripped off the wounds, and you revisit that. I'm still really impacted at a really gut emotional level when I see the videos and replay those.
He's having something of a flashback right there, Joanne.
Yes.
It's exactly what you deal with every day.
Yes, you do. But the way to manage a lot of this is through a process. We desensitize from it so that we can maybe have a neutral emotion within ourselves without getting re-traumatized or flooded by re-experiencing. You know, fear is a major, major issue, especially with coming back this year. Some people have not been here since last year. So coming back, hopefully they're going to get on the course and desensitize themselves or just self-regulate so that they can feel at least stable and safe and secure. I think anytime this happens, we can never promise we're all going to be safe. But I think what we've learned is if we come together as a team, there's help, there's hope, and there's faith that we'll all be okay.
And that's so true, Joanne. I think that, you know, one of the things that we learned in retrospect is that we're, if you will, tempered and hardened by the experience, in the sense that we're even more united now. And I think that's why you've seen not a diminution in the number of people that are running, but we've got over 37,000 runners that are going to be participating. And it's the idea that, you know, the core emotion of resiliency, of never giving up, of moving forward, and that's very characteristic of the marathon, what it takes to run or train from a marathon, as Joanne and I have been experiencing over the past several months. But I think it's absolutely characteristic of the region.
Dr. Cobb, Joanne, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Dr. Perrin Cobb is the director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Critical Care Center, and Joanne Pomodoro is a clinical social worker at MGH Back Bay. So many runners and fans remembering, Boston will run again next week when all the commemorations are behind it and us. For so many running, it will mean a lot more in 2014. The organizers of this year's marathon have invited everyone who wasn't able to make it to the finish due to the tragedy to come back and cross that finish line. Give us your part of the story. Call in at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can always leave a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting today from WGBH in Boston. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com, with tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. Help is available at 1-800-REPUTATION or at reputation.com. TiVo, delivering cable TV and internet TV together in one searchable and unified viewing experience. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.